Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I appreciate you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. It is a lovely sunny day out there. I hope that you are able to get outside and get some sunshine. As I like to say, your February self will thank you for soaking up that sunshine now. Lots to do on the program today. In a bit, we're going to be talking about the Cook County soda tax. We're going to be talking a little bit about because this has been in the news a lot lately, just in the last week in particular, about gene editing. So that is a thing that occurred, and we're going to be talking about a little more, particularly like the ethical issues around it, because it's raised a lot of questions. And, of course, we're also going to be talking about Navy Pier and funds and Rahm Emanuel. Lots to talk about there. But before we get to all that, please welcome to the program Nelson Schwartz, who is the economics reporter at New York Times. Nelson, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. I appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday. So there's a piece that you wrote recently, and everybody, you can find this at newyorktimes.com. It's all about Foxconn, the Taiwanese electronic supplier. They make parts for Apple and other tech giants. So Wednesday, it said it was going to open up the first major U.S. factory in Wisconsin. And quickly, this became a very, very political discussion. So talk us through that, if you would, Nelson.
Sure. Foxconn's the biggest electronics manufacturer in the world. You know, it makes iPhones and all sorts of products that we use. We don't know their name, but that's who makes a lot of the innards. And basically, the Trump administration wants to see more manufacturing in the United States. And the company has, sort of talked and made commitments in the past, but now they've promised to build a $10 billion with a B plant in Wisconsin. There was a big announcement at the White House with the president, with Governor Walker of Wisconsin, with Speaker Ryan, who's the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and the plant, coincidentally or not coincidentally, is going to be located in his district. So, obviously, the Trump administration wants to draw attention to this $10 billion plant could employ initially up to 3,000 people. But there's definitely, a political benefit for the company and for those officials.
Indeed. And it's interesting to look to Wisconsin just because we've seen other manufacturing in that area struggle so much. In particular, I'm thinking of Harley-Davidson.
Yeah, exactly. Harley-Davidson, is wrestling with some demographic issues. People aren't buying as many motorcycles. They've laid off, some people in Milwaukee. And, I was doing some research. I actually went to school in University of Chicago, so I'm familiar with the area. Towns like Kenosha and Racine are, struggled industrially. So this is a big win. But the controversy is that the state is going to provide $3 billion, again, with a B, in tax breaks and subsidies for Foxconn. That's very controversial, because as much as we want to see, new factories, new employment, new high tech jobs in a place like Wisconsin, all the other businesses that are paying, aren't getting tax breaks don't like that, let alone, taxpayers who, the money's got to come from somewhere.
Indeed. And so as we are looking through all this and considering all these moving parts and how it became politicized, how was Foxconn lured to Wisconsin initially when there's, infinite choices of places to be?
They were looking at a few states, including Michigan and other Midwestern states. The Trump administration, they had kind of been dealing with the Trump administration about coming to the United States and opening a big plant. The Trump administration didn't pick Wisconsin, but sort of put them in touch and, connected them with, the governor of Michigan was involved. And I think what it came down to was Wisconsin had good transportation logistics, good workforce, but my sense is they came up with the best incentive package, the best subsidy package. Because by contrast, a few years ago, Foxconn promised to build a big plant in Pennsylvania, but nothing ever happened. It was kind of hot air, and the reason Foxconn says it didn't do it is because Pennsylvania never came up with the subsidies, you know, tax breaks, whatever you want to call them. And I think, again, Wisconsin did, and the governor is calling a special session of the legislature to approve the tax breaks, which, as I mentioned, they're controversial. You know, I'm on Twitter now, and, you know, sort of at Nelson Schwartz, and you'll see the commentary. I mean, a lot of people are mad about the subsidies. On the other hand, some people say, look, you know, these are very, very good jobs, and that by building a high-tech plant like this, you kind of create a network of suppliers. And, you know, all those workers, they go out and go to restaurants and go to the movies, what have you, and that helps the overall economy. But, you know, I think that's the debate, and that's why it's so political.
And so politics aside, I know there are some other complications in that, President Trump had said earlier this week that Apple had promised to build three large plants here. And Apple far in the past had said it would be very difficult to move to the United States. So all of that aside, all the political part aside, when we're looking at drawbacks and benefits of this move, what are we looking at?
I mean, the benefits are you're going to have, you know, consumer electronics, you know, LCD screens, you know, things we all use every day made in the United States again. I mean, you know, the first I remember from my grandparents, like a Zenith and RCA, those TVs, they were made in the USA. We haven't made TVs in the US in decades. So, you know, that is a loss. But on the other hand, that's good. And so we want this kind of high-end advanced manufacturing because, again, you get a lot of suppliers in the area. And, you know, Wisconsin is not such a high-tech manufacturer. It's more old, you know, old economy, like automobiles, motorcycles, we said, like Harley Davidson, you know, cranes, you know, that kind of stuff. So this is good. I mean, I think the downside is, this is going to cost $3 billion in tax breaks. Hopefully, you know, this will create enough jobs and Foxconn will come through and live up to their commitments. In other parts of the world, they've made big, big promises. I'm talking like in India and Brazil, and what was actually built didn't match up to the, you know, initial media hype.
Right, right. Well, we will keep turning to you for the latest as this continues to unroll. Thank you so much for being with us today, Nelson Schwartz, economics reporter at New York Times.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Thanks so much. All right. We are going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are talking about the Cook County soda tax. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hi there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with us. Most grateful to you for that. A little bit later on the other side of news, we're going to be talking about gene editing because that is suddenly on a lot of people's minds, particularly the ethics around it. And we're also going to be talking all about Navy Pier renovation and funding and the Emanuel administration. Lots to talk about there. But before we do that, regular contributor to this program, Greg Trotter, is here. He, of course, covers the food industry for Chicago Tribune. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for being with us today. Okay, so all eyes on Wednesday for the Cook County soda tax. There was a delay. There was some pending appeal, but things appear to be going forward, and the tax is scheduled to begin on Wednesday, and there is a lot of consternation around that. Talk us through it, if you would.
Yeah, that's right. It was actually a bit of a surprise, I think, for many yesterday. So last month, the Illinois Retail Merchants Association filed a lawsuit alleging the tax was unconstitutional and vague. This was, the penny per ounce sweetened beverage tax on all sugar and artificially sweetened beverages in Cook County that was approved in Cook County last fall. So this lawsuit, basically the Retail Merchants Association filed this lawsuit. The judge put in this temporary restraining order, which delayed the tax. It's been delayed since June 30th. It was supposed to go into effect July 1st. And I think a lot of people sort of figured that the lawsuit would continue on. But yesterday, the judge ruled in favor of the county, and they granted their motion to dismiss the lawsuit and dissolve the temporary restraining order. And so the tax is now scheduled to go into effect Wednesday. There's still a possibility that the Illinois Retail Merchants Association will appeal the decision. If that happens, you know, it's possible it could be stalled again, but that's not likely to happen before Wednesday.
And so the Cook County Circuit Judge who made this ruling said the court is not charged with evaluating the progressive or regressive nature of this tax or any tax. And I think that was a key statement in this, because it seems like a lot of the consternation is really centering around that part of the debate.
That's right. Yeah, I thought that was interesting, too. I mean, he basically said, you know, there he's essentially saying I'm not here to say whether it's a good or bad tax. He basically found that it was not unconstitutional and that it was within the Cook County's home rule authority to levy the tax.
Right. And that part really is interesting. I mean, it does seem a little unbalanced in a couple of different ways, not only how the tax would be distributed and how it potentially could disproportionately impact some people and not others. And what I think is also very interesting is how it is defined. I mean, there is non-sweet plain club soda that will be taxed, whereas I call them Starbucks milkshakes that are, you know, supposed to be coffee but really have a ton of sugar in them, those will not be. And I think that part is really interesting too, just how it is being defined and what we are calling a sugary beverage.
Yeah, it's true, and it's really interesting, and I would say there's a lot of confusion there. I've heard from a lot of readers via email and on Twitter, you know, is this or that going to be taxed? One woman was claiming her LaCroix is going to be taxed, which is not true. That's not accurate. Mm-hmm. If it's, you know, LaCroix does not have sugar or artificial sweeteners, so your LaCroix is safe. But there's a lot of drinks that it does apply to, and artificial sweeteners could include stevia or monk's fruit.
Right.
Which would be taxed. And so, you know, that's part of the complex thing about this. These types of taxes are popping up all over the country in San Francisco, Oakland, Boulder, Berkeley, Philadelphia. And in some of them are just sugar sweetened beverages, such as Berkeley, and others are both sugar and artificially sweetened. The public health case to make is really linked to the sugar sweetened beverages. And so the you know, sugar sweetened beverages have been linked to obesity and diabetes and heart condition. The science is sort of still out on artificially sweetened beverages. But, you know, it's at Cook County President Tony Preckwinkle has been forthright all along that, you know, this is about revenue first and foremost. The county needs the money to sustain its services. But that it will also have a public health impact. And so there is some of the controversy, you know. Obviously, you know, many consumers would dispute that. Retailers are upset because they believe that shoppers will just take their business across county line, and they feel like it's a burden to implement. So there's definitely a lot of controversy from both retailers and consumers.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to ask you, is how are you, what are you hearing from retailers? Does it seem like the implementation will be a simple one, or will it be as confusing for retailers as for many consumers?
I think it depends. I mean, I think for, you know, this was supposed to go into effect July 1st. So I think most retailers are ready to go, haven't been ready to go. You know, it's obviously a bigger challenge and a greater expense for small retailers to implement this kind of thing. You know, the larger retailers, less of an issue, I would say. You know, but there's been some changes in the regulations leading up to the July 1st that has confused some retailers. Frankly, it's hard to truly gauge. The opposition is a group called the Can the Tax Coalition, which is funded by the American Beverage Association, which is the trade group for Pepsi and Coke and other large beverage companies. And they've been fighting these taxes all over the country and spending millions of dollars to do it. There's a lot of money at stake here. And so, you know, as part of their campaign, they're definitely you know, they're very outspoken about their concerns and sort of galvanizing retailers as into that opposition. So, you know, I think any new tax is going to be debated and argued by, you know, the sort of people or entities that it affects. And so that's what's happening to some degree.
Sure. Certainly. And as you note in the piece that you wrote, and everybody can find this at chicagotribune.com, I will also share it on social media. The tax is expected to bring in $67.5 million this year and $200.6 million in 2018, which is really not an insignificant amount at all. What are some other lessons or things to highlight as we're looking to other cities? I've been following Philly a little bit because it seems extremely contentious there as well.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of lessons, I mean, it's what's interesting is like they're similar, but they're also different too.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of how they're implemented, and like the specifics are different depending on, you know, a given state's laws or environmental kind of regulatory climates. And so it's like Philly, for example, the tax is on distributors; it's not at the point of sale. So that's a pretty key difference. You know, it does apply to people who receive food stamp benefits there. So they were able to do that there. This tax does not, because you can't apply state or local sales taxes to food stamp purchases under federal law. And so that the Cook County tax is at the point of sale, so therefore it does not apply to SNAP purchases. So that's another thing that a lot of people are upset about. Look, you know, saying, hey, you say this is a public health thing. What about these, you know, communities of low income people? They're not going to have to pay the tax. So that's another sort of point of controversy. The county basically has been saying, well, this is better than nothing from a public health perspective. And people go in and out of that program, the SNAP program that is, and will, you know, pay the tax at some point eventually. So it's, you know, I'm a little bit of a tangent there, but that's all just to say it is hard to compare.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to compare even with Berkeley, obviously. You know, Cook County and Berkeley are very different places.
Certainly.
And a lot of public support for it there. And so I guess we'll just, you know, have to see
what happens after Wednesday. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
We will keep turning to you for the latest as it does continue on. Thank you so much for being with us today. Greg Trotter, who covers the food industry at Chicago Tribune.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much. All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff. And when we come back, we are talking about gene editing. Definitely want to stick around for that. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Still lots to do on the program. We're going to be talking a little bit later about the Emanuel administration and Navy Pier. Lots of conversation going on about that right now on social media and everywhere. But before that, we are joined now by Vivek Wadhwa, who is an academic and researcher and author of Driver in the Driverless Car, who recently wrote in the Washington Post about gene editing, which has been a really interesting topic. And it's been, I know, a lot of stuff in my social media feeds about it lately because a big, big advance was just recently made. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi there.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking time out of your Saturday to join us. So talk us through this piece that you wrote, because gene editing is such a fascinating topic. And in particular, the headline on this piece in the Washington Post is very provocative. And it is, if you could design your own child, would you do it? And it really points to how much we need to be having conversations around the ethical implications of all of these gene related advancements that we're making.
Yeah, you know, for the last 10 or 15 years, we've been talking about reading DNA, being able to decipher it. 5 years ago, there were some breakthroughs made at MIT and Berkeley, UC Berkeley, in which they figured out how to edit the DNA. And over the last year or two, they started experimenting with embryos, with human beings. And now a group in Portland, Oregon, looks like they've discovered how to reliably, accurately edit embryos. Now, this is terrifying and exciting at the same time, because exciting because we could be eliminating hereditary diseases. Imagine removing Huntington's disease from our DNA altogether. You know, your mother used to have a migraine, you had a migraine. Well, imagine now your child not having to have that. But terrifying means you could also create killer viruses. And then we get into this issue of eugenics. What if we could now add IQ to our children? Would we do it? Let me ask you, would you do it if you had an option? If you had the option of now designing the color of your child's eyes, deciding how much IQ they're going to have, where would you draw the line?
I think it is a really, really interesting topic. I mean, I think the ethical implications around it are really, really fascinating ones, because I think a lot of people are suddenly having that conversation of like, well, what would I do? I mean, I think it's easy for people to say, well, if I could spare my child suffering, medically somehow, I would do it. But then it's like, well, when we start thinking about things that are not maybe about suffering, right, then it becomes a little different when we're talking about adding height or changing eye color or things like that, that it gets really, really interesting. And so who are kind of the main voices in this debate, and who's having and leading this charge of this around these conversations?
The trouble is that the National Academies got together and about a year ago, they said, okay, we need a moratorium on it. And then in February this year, they said, well, let's go ahead and do it on a limited basis, but let's be good. The problem is that, you know, we don't understand. The public is not aware of what has become possible. And no one is controlling it. Now, what really worries me is that China is leading the charge here. We have ethical concerns, and we would be very careful about editing children. But in China, it's all about racing ahead in science. So they've taken the lead on editing animals. Already you can buy, micro pigs in China. I mean, they're editing all sorts of animals and doing all sorts of crazy things with this technology. So where do we draw the line is what the question is.
Right. And when we think about other species besides humans, I think another topic that comes up that is kind of interesting is when we talk about extinction. So if there is preserved DNA, the idea of reviving or helping speed up, the reproduction of a species to help stem being on an endangered list.
That's already happening. At Harvard, George Church and his team are trying to bring back the woolly mammoth. There's scientists who believe that one of the reasons for global warming is that we don't have the mammoth in the tundra compressing ice under their feet anymore. So they want to bring back the mammoth. And what they've done is that they've found ancient species of elephants, and they're trying to bring them back. They're trying to now engineer the DNA so that they can bring back the mammoth. Now, start thinking about Jurassic Park. If we found the DNA of raptors, perhaps we could re-engineer, some animals to be dinosaurs like we saw in science fiction. This is all sort of happening right now with people not being aware of it.
Well, you mentioned Jurassic Park, and immediately I think of Jurassic Park and Animal Farm, and where we see this break bad. Anybody that's read any kind of thing like that knows that there's always, anytime it's been imagined in a fictitious way, there's always this downside. There's always this unexpected, result that happens. And yet when we, having the ability to be at this moment in the innovation world, it is, as you say, it is both terrifying and very, very exciting. And so kind of what are the next steps? So we've just seen this happen in Portland, this group of scientists who say they have successfully edited the genes of a human embryo. What should we be looking for soon on the horizon as we're looking at this topic that will be coming next?
This is what my book was about, that I tried to raise awareness of not only this, but a whole number of other technologies, including artificial intelligence, including robots, including drones. I mean, there are a whole bunch of technologies that are now on these exponential curves, and they're converging, and they're making amazing and scary things possible. We got to start learning it, because ultimately it's our choice. You know, the way our laws work, or the way our policymakers work, or are supposed to work, is that laws are codified ethics. Ethics are consensus that's developed by, society. And it often takes a long time, a lot of learning to develop, consensus on what's ethical. We better start learning this stuff, because this future is happening. It's not science fiction anymore. You may think that it's not possible. It is possible, and it's happening. And there are a whole range of technologies in which these advances are happening. So the answer to your question is, let's figure this out. And let's get together and let's tell our policymakers what we think consider to be acceptable.
Well, indeed, that's easier said than done, I suppose. But there is a lot to consider, as you point out. I have to imagine the creation of your book was a bit of a paranoid experience for you. There's so much to consider and so many things to worry about that you've raised.
Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is how I felt like, because on the one hand, I'm saying, hey, look at all this thing. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be magical. And then I sober down and say, well, here are all the risks and here are the choices you have to make. So this is, but this is where we are today.
Right.
That amazement and fear at the same time. And my conclusion is that we now have two possible choices. One is that we can build this amazing Star Trek future, the utopia that we saw in science fiction, or we could end up in Mad Max. Mad Max means that we're ripping each other apart and we're destroying humanity. It's binary as far as I'm concerned. It's one or the other. And it's the choices we make that are going to determine the outcome.
Indeed, you've raised a lot of things for us to think about. The book is called Driver in the Driverless Car. Vivek Wadhwa, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are talking about all that funding and Navy Pier and the Emanuel administration. Lots to discuss around that. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with me. Very grateful to you for that. Well, as promised, let us raise the big conversation that is happening right now. The Emanuel administration has signed off on an elaborate, oh boy, there's so much. As soon as I even say that, all this stuff starts to bubble up because, as you know, a lot of conversation has been going on right now around Navy Pier funding for its rehabilitation and change and expansion and all that, the Emanuel administration and other districts of the city. Here to talk about that with us is Danny Ecker, reporter at Cranes Chicago. Hi, Danny. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Well, this topic is a big one because, I mean, every time it's been on social media for quite a while, and it just keeps getting more and more contentious. A little bit earlier, we were talking about the soda tax in Cook County, and I feel like this is another topic that is just extremely contentious and really fascinating. But this piece that you have at ChicagoBusiness.com is really, really fascinating and really brings a lot of numbers and considerations up to the surface. So talk us through those, if you would.
Yeah, sure. So, and this was a joint investigation that we did at Cranes with the Better Government Association. Basically, this was a pretty egregious example of tax dollars being said they're going to be used one way, and then there's actually a totally different plan happening behind the scenes. This involved the 1,200-room Marriott Hotel, which actually opens next month, next to McCormick Place. It was actually back in, so it was 2013, so about 4 years ago, they announced that this plan was going to be happening. They were going to put a hotel and then the arena, which is going to be the home of DePaul basketball, and they announced the Navy Pier renovation. Well, at the time, they said that $55 million in TIF money, so tax increment financing money, which is basically property tax dollars from the surrounding neighborhoods around McCormick Place in the near south side, that was going to go toward the hotel. And it was well publicized. It got a lot of scrutiny because, I mean, it was a hotel subsidy at a time when the city was closing schools and has other financial problems. And that was basically still what the public and what aldermen thought the money was going to. What we discovered was that there was actually this plan going on behind the scenes that the folks, the leadership at McCormick Place and the mayor's office, they had concocted this shell game, effectively. In which they were going to use the $55 million and kind of use McCormick Place as a conduit to actually redirect the money to Navy Pier, which is run by a private nonprofit organization and needed money because it was running out of money for its renovation, needed to get money fairly quickly. And so they ended up, in the words of the executives at McCormick Place, they used McCormick Place as a middleman to reroute the money to Navy Pier. And somehow, nobody except for a few people, city power players, I guess you could call them, really knew about it.
Which is such an interesting piece of this, that something so large could be such a well-kept secret.
Yeah. And that was, I mean, when we first came across these emails, you know, that were are so brazen. They're just totally blunt in how they explain this. We were scratching our heads going, wait a minute, do we just not know about this? And this was the plan the whole time, and we just didn't understand this. You know, and then we started looking into this and asking more people, and it turns out nobody knew. Not even Alderman Dowell, who's the third ward alderman, who, you know, whose ward includes McCormick Place and who is basically the champion of this whole hotel project. She had no idea. We went to her. She learned it from us. John Chase of the Better Government Association, when we went over and asked her about it, she was clueless. So, you know, that was just really stunning to see that it was only just this small group of people that was doing this behind the scenes.
Sure. And so how was it? What was it that set these cards falling that sort of uncovered this in the first place?
Yeah, initially, a couple emails that sort of hinted at this that were, and this is all public record, emails that were gotten through public record searches by the BGA. We started working together on it and found even more and found, you know, looked up all the records that showed that, you know, the folks at McCormick Place had all the money they needed, which is, you know, for the hotel, which is a big no-no when it comes to tips, is that, you know, you have to prove that you can't do a project but for the TIF money coming in to help you. And so that was sort of a one discovery. And then, you know, the other was that, you know, NPI, Navy Pier Inc., which runs Navy Pier, that's, you know, they needed the money. And so these emails just laid it out. As I mentioned, you know, they're just so blunt. You know, the quotes in some of the emails that where they describe it as it's a one-time arrangement. We're just the middleman. We don't actually get any funding. You know, it was just sort of an amazing thing to see.
Wow, I'm sure that was really something else to uncover throughout your work on this. And as you note in the piece that you did, you can find this at chicagobusiness.com. There are some specific mentions of sort of overall issues with TIF in the first place and kind of an elasticity of some of the rules and regulation around it that perhaps mm-hmm. makes this I don't want to say not surprising because it is surprising and very significant, but it seems like perhaps this could be happening, you know, in other times, in other ways, just because those kind of murky perimeters around TIF.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a really big example of what has always been a criticism of TIFs. I mean, this program can be effective, you know, this program as an economic tool to spur development in blighted areas. You know, that's what it's designed for. But unfortunately, it's developed a reputation under Mayor Emanuel and Mayor Daley before him of basically being used as a slush fund for the mayor to fund vanity projects. You know, the problem is that there's very little oversight. Once the city council approves, you know, a TIF expenditure for a project, you don't really have much visibility into how the money is actually used. You know, there's a contract that they sign that says this is how it's going to be used, but there's not much follow-up. There's very little transparency. It's you know, basically one of those that's really the biggest complaint about TIFs. And that's something that you'd hope cases like this, you know, maybe help push regulations to get a little bit tighter and for aldermen to be even more skeptical than they already should be when they're getting a application or proposal for a TIF expenditure.
Mm-hmm. And so do you think that there could be reform on the horizon, given the high stakes and just brazen nature of this particular case? Do you get a sense that there's a bit of a groundswell around some sort of reform or greater regulation around TIFs?
Yeah, I really hope so. I think, you know, we started to see this week, we saw some aldermen, you know, who were pretty vocal about their outrage over this thing and the lack of transparency. There is an ordinance, actually, that was floated to the city council last fall and it's kind of been sitting around that, you know, will tighten up some of the language around the TIF program in terms of making certain things legal standards as opposed to just guideposts for determining whether they can award a TIF. You know, there are a number of aldermen who you know, really would like to tighten up this program and make it more transparent and make more steps that where this, you know, where they where this something like this could be caught. But it's tough. It's tough to really see whether there's going to be enough of a groundswell to really get something like that through. It really comes down to aldermen ultimately being just far more diligent about TIF proposals and when TIF money is being awarded, to really dig in as much as possible to exactly how it's going to be used and what kind of guarantees they have in place to make sure it will be used that way.
Right. And in this particular case, what are the next steps we can expect to see on the horizon?
Well, you know, we kind of thought there'd be more. We heard Alderman Dell, a day after the story was published, or the day the story was published, actually, called for public hearings, and there were a couple of them where aldermen were grilling planning commissioners and the folks from MPEA and McCormick Place on Monday. But there hasn't really been much of an effort. There's certainly been protests. There were some protesters at Navy Pier and at City Council about this. At this point, where there's not really a next step right now to, a new hearing that's coming or anything like that. But, I'm sure aldermen will probably be bringing this up for some time as a classic case of why they should not be approving TIFs. And I would think it would have legs that way.
Yeah, I imagine so. Well, we will keep turning to you at ChicagoBusiness.com. Really fascinating piece here that you can find. And again, it was a joint investigation that you did with the Better Government Association. Really, really interesting stuff and fascinating information in this piece. So thanks so much for being with us today. Danny Ecker, reporter at Cranes Chicago.
Thanks, Amy.
Thanks so much. All right, we're going to take a break and get you to news and then turn you over to Scott Catoon back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.